going to go ahead and read the thing. The Woodstock Music Festival was a landmark moment in history, not just for the amazing musical performances or the sheer luck of the organizers, but as the absolute height of the peace and love culture of the 1960s. Billed as 3 days of peace and music, the festival largely fulfilled its promise of being a fairly well-organized, mostly peaceful, mostly successful festival. The performances have gone down in legend, from Ravi Shankar playing in the rain, to Joan Baez being 6 months pregnant and delivering a great set, Carlos Santana self-reportedly hallucinating on mescaline while he played, The Who's incredible Sunrise performance, and Jimi Hendrix's iconic rendition of the American National Anthem. Nearly 500,000 people were there in the mud at a dairy farm in Bethel, New York. Despite some pretty massive issues having to do with the performers' money and behavior, on the whole, when you ask music historians and people who look at the hippie and counterculture movements of the 1960s, Woodstock is pointed to as the height. Only 4 months later, it would all be definitively and decisively destroyed. On the other coast of the United States, what should have been a similar celebration of peace and music became instead a boot stomp to the entire concept. When the event ended, 4 people were dead, massive amounts of property had been destroyed, and a vicious level of violence had shown the world what Rolling Stone magazine termed rock and roll's worst day. On this episode of Relative Disasters, the Altamont Free Concert. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I strum a little chord and loop it back into a podcast that I send out to my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. My much cooler big sister and I manage our existential dread by talking with each other about terrible and interesting historical events, their contexts, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to be distracting. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, today we're going to be talking about music, organization, and violence. Our sources for this episode include The Rolling Stones' Disaster at Altamont, Let It Bleed, attributed to the writers of Rolling Stone in Rolling Stone magazine from January of 1971, Gimme Shelter, The True Story by Michael Sragow, published in Salon in 2000, the 1970 documentary Gimme Shelter, and a truly massive amount of contemporary and retrospective articles on the subject. If the road to hell is paved with good intentions, it is also paved with inept planning. The genesis for the idea of what would become the Altamont concert was when the Rolling Stones made a decision, based on criticism that they were receiving from the 1969 tour, that their shows were great but the ticket prices were too high. Their response was to end the tour with a free show in San Francisco. The initial venue was supposed to be the practice field at San Jose State University. Thanks to scheduling and happenstance, the Grateful Dead joined on to play as well. However, that venue had just hosted a big music festival, and they were in no mood to host another one so soon. They turned to Golden Gate Park next, but an American football game was scheduled at the Kezar Stadium in the park, so hosting both was impossible. They tried to get the Sears Point Raceway near Sonoma, but couldn't come up with the security deposit and couldn't settle on terms, so they finally decided on the Altamont Raceway near Tracy, California. This last change was made on Thursday, December 4th, and the concert was supposed to happen on Saturday the 6th. Such a last-minute change made logistics impossible. They didn't have enough time to get porta-potties, they didn't have enough time to get enough medical tents, they didn't have time to get professional security. Also, the stage area was not good for a concert of this size. The stage was at the bottom of a sloping area, meaning that if enough people came, they would be crushed down towards the stage by gravity. There wasn't enough time to build a raised stage or even put another stage platform under the one they were going to use. Because the stage was so low, it was a real concern that audience members might jump up on stage and disrupt performances or possibly even threaten performers. In concerts in the San Francisco area, both the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Starship, who were also going to play the show, had hired the local chapter of Hell's Angels to act as security, putting themselves between the stage and the crowd and making sure nobody got too close. Acting on that suggestion, the organizers, and it's not clear exactly who, arranged to pay the local chapter of Hell's Angel in beer to serve as a barrier for the performers on stage. However, they weren't hiring the Hell's Angels chapter of San Francisco. They ended up getting the much more violent Oakland chapter. The show opened with Santana, and right away the vibe was about as un-Woodstock as you can imagine. People had been there all day, drinking and engaging in chemical alterations and waiting for the show to start, which, you know, was very Woodstocky, as acid and pot were favorites of the crowd, with various other uppers and downers being in wide use. The crowd and the Hell's Angels were awash in alcohol. But instead of the laid-back, chilled party atmosphere that had been the hope, the crowd was apprehensive, nervous, angry, irritated, a little bit hostile, and the bikers were definitely hostile, viewing the crowd and many of the performers with open contempt. As Santana launched into their second song, a man attempted to get on stage, and the Hell's Angels beat the tar out of him, kicking him with heavy boots and striking with weighted pool cues, eventually leaving the bloodied young man immobile on the ground, unable to move under his own power and unable to be moved through the crowd due to the crush. They attacked a photographer who had taken pictures of this event, beating him as he curled into a fetal position before cracking his camera open and destroying the film inside. Santana's next song was interrupted by the Hell's Angels running across the stage to attack another audience member. Jefferson Airplane was up next. Their set was delayed a little bit due to more violence, and once they started playing, more violence erupted. Their lead singer attempted to stop the Hell's Angels from beating on a young woman and was promptly knocked unconscious with a punch. Another member of the band got on the mic to sort of mock the Angels for what they'd just done and try to defuse the situation a little bit, and one of the bikers got on another mic and warned the bands. It was at this point that the Grateful Dead got into a helicopter and bailed, understanding that the violence was already out of control. The Hell's Angels had control of the stage, not the organizers, and certainly not the performers. 100 or so Hell's Angels against 300,000 people in the audience, and the Angels reigned undisputed. The Flying Burrito Brothers took the stage next, and the violence calmed a bit. Nobody rushed the stage, nobody was beaten senseless. The Angels drank their beer and sat on the stage, sometimes tossing full beer cans at the crowd, sometimes heckling back and forth with the crowd, but that was about it. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were up next, and the undercurrent returned. The crowd began to push closer again, and the Angels pushed back. Finally, an organized charge of Hell's Angels and their weighted pool cues and bike chains forced the people back again, and somewhere in the fracas, Stephen Stills got stabbed in the leg by an Angel armed with a bike spoke. After CSNY got off the stage, the lights went down. People began to light fires in the crowd, some made up of garbage, some made up of the raceway fencing they pulled apart. The Rolling Stones were refusing to come out. They were tuning up, or they were waiting for more darkness, or they were being prima donnas, or they were scared. The long absence began to agitate the crowd. The Hell's Angels massed at the front of the stage, and then on the stage itself. Bottles and full cans were thrown. Beatings happened. After an hour and a half, the crowd erupted when the Rolling Stones took to the stage, wedged uncomfortably between the Hell's Angels, who were not leaving. An estimated 200 people were on the stage, and six of them were the Stones. Mick Jagger led off with Jumpin' Jack Flash, and the crowd roared and danced. Jagger couldn't really dance because he was nearly shoulder to shoulder with the Angels. They performed Carol next, and then opened up Sympathy for the Devil, and had to stop in the middle as another huge bout of violence erupted. A mass of people had pushed up to the stage, and the Angels had begun to lay about them and beat them back. One of them was 18-year-old Meredith Hunter. Meredith Hunter was from Berkeley, California. He enjoyed dressing with the flashy styles of the African-American community at the time, and he wore his hair in a big afro. He, his girlfriend, his friend, and his friend's girlfriend had all traveled to see the Stones at Altamont. Meredith's sister Gwen had warned him about the racism still threatening the African-American community in the outer Alameda County areas, so he had brought a Smith & Wesson 22 caliber revolver for protection. Caught up in the push, Hunter was among those forced back by the chains and clubs of the Hell's Angels, and once the crowd was sufficiently cowed, the Stones restarted Sympathy for the Devil. They pushed on through an improvised instrumental to try to cool down the crowd, and then Stray Cat Blues, Love in Vain, and Under My Thumb. Under My Thumb would be the last song Meredith Hunter would live to hear. What happened next is disputed by the survivors and witnesses, since Hunter cannot speak for himself. According to some witnesses, he looked like he was high and violent. According to others, he looked dazed from the beating he'd just received. Either he produced the gun first and then one of the Hell's Angels stabbed him, or he saw the angel coming at him with a knife and drew his gun to defend himself. As Mick Jagger begged the crowd to cool down, to stop fighting, to please stop, and as Keith Richards stepped up to say that they'd quit playing if people didn't cool it, Meredith Hunter bled in the mud. Jagger called for a doctor, asking the crowd to move, that somebody'd been hurt. The following is from a shortly-after-the-fact interview conducted by a reporter from Rolling Stone magazine with someone who was present at the entire incident. When Hunter had climbed up towards the stage, one of the Hell's Angels had grabbed his afro and laughed at him. Reporter: Now this guy that you're talking about, is this the black guy that got killed? Answer: Yes, right. He shook loose and the Hell's Angel hit him in the mouth and he fell back into the crowd and the angel jumped off stage and jumped at him. And he tried to scramble, you know, through the crowd to run from the Hell's Angel and four other Hell's Angels jumped on him. They started mugging him and... Reporter: This is when they claim he had the gun? Answer: No, he didn't pull out the gun yet. See, and they were mugging him, and then he started running. He was running straight into the crowd, you know, pushing people away, you know, to run from the Hell's Angels. Reporter: What was this guy's condition? Had he been smoking? Had he been drinking? Or do you know? Answer: He was really straight. He was really feeling weird about pushed around and stuff, but he was really pretty straight. Reporter: When the cat started grabbing him, what did he say? What did the black guy say? Answer: He just gave him a weird look, kind of a mean look, and yanked away. He didn't give him any verbal provocation or anything. So they're chasing him through the crowd, and they're hitting him, and one Hell's Angels pulled out a knife and stabbed him in the back. Reporter: What kind of knife? Answer: I couldn't tell. I just saw the flash of the blade. Everything was happening too fast. And he hit him in the back, and he pulled out the gun and held it up in the air, you know, like that was kind of his last resort, you know. And reporter: Like a service revolver or something? Answer: Yeah, he had it in the air and he was still running and people were telling him. I remember this chick screaming, "Don't shoot anyone." And he was too scared to shoot because he could have shot anyone in the crowd or anything. So he didn't shoot. And one of the Hell's Angels grabbed the gun from him and then stabbed him again in the back. Reporter: They grabbed the gun from him and then stabbed him again in the back? Answer: Yeah. Reporter: Would you be willing to testify? Answer: No, I don't want to get killed. They hit him. I couldn't tell whether it was a knife or not, but on the side of the head, and then he kind of stumbled and he fell down on his knees. He came running towards me. I grabbed onto the scaffold, held onto the scaffold, you know, and then he came running kind of towards me, and then he fell down on his knees, and then the Hell's Angel, the same one I was talking about, he grabbed onto both of his shoulders and started kicking him in the face about 5 times or so, and then he fell down on his face, you know. He let go and he fell down on his face, and then one of them kicked him in the side and he rolled over and he said something. He said, "I wasn't going to shoot you." That was the last thing he said. Reporter: How close were you to all of this? Answer: About 3 feet away. Reporter: You kept right up with them. You could have gotten hurt. Answer: I just stayed as close. Like, I wanted to jump into it, but I couldn't, so I stayed close so that as soon as they were done mugging him, I could help him. Reporter: That's the real question there. Why 299,900 people would allow themselves to be dominated by 100 angels? Answer. Yeah, well, I couldn't see it either. If some other people had jumped in, I would have jumped in, but nobody jumped in, and after he said, I wasn't going to shoot you, one of the Hell's Angels said, why did you have the gun? He didn't give him time to say anything. He grabbed one of those garbage cans, you know, one of those cardboard garbage cans with the metal rimming, and he smashed him over the head with it, and then he kicked the garbage can out of the way and just started kicking his head in. Five of them started kicking his head in, kicked him all over the place. And then the guy that started the whole thing, the fat guy who grabbed his hair, he stood there for a minute or so, and then he walked off. And then the ones I was talking about, describing to you, they wouldn't let us touch him for like 2 or 3 minutes. Like, don't touch him. He's going to die anyway. Let him die. He's going to die. Reporter. So what did everybody do? Did anybody say anything? Answer. It was all confusion. I jumped down anyway to grab him, and some other dude jumped down and grabbed him, and then the Hell's Angels just stood over him for a little bit and walked away. We turned him over, and we ripped off his shirt. We rubbed his back up and down to get the blood off so we could see, and there was this big hole on his spine, and a big hole in his side, and a big hole in his temple. Big open slice. You could see all the way in. You could see inside. You could see at least an inch down and stuff, you know. And there was a big hole right where there's no ribs in his back, and then the side of his head was just sliced open. You couldn't see so far in, but it was bleeding quite heavy. And his back wasn't bleeding too heavy after that. All of us were drenched in blood. I picked up his legs, and someone else, this guy said he was a doctor or something, I don't know who he was. He picked up his arms and he says, we got to get him some help because he's going to die. We got 15 or 20 minutes if we can get him some help. And so we tried to carry him on the stage, tell Mick Jagger to stop playing so we could get him on the stage and get some attention for him. Reporter, who told Jagger that? Answer, well, nobody told Jagger that, but somebody was trying to tell him to stop, and he kept leaning over and looking out at the crowd like he was paying attention and trying to figure out what was happening. Reporter, this is while he's singing? Answer, yeah. He kept leaning over with his ear, trying to hear what somebody was telling him, but he couldn't hear. So they kept on playing, and the Hell's Angels wouldn't let us through to get on the stage. They kept blocking us and saying, go around, go some other way. They wouldn't let us through. And they knew he was going to die in a matter of minutes. They wanted him to die, probably, so he couldn't talk about it or something, you know? And so we turned around, and we went the other way. It took about 15 minutes to get him behind the stage. We went behind the whole thing and got behind where there was a Red Cross truck, something like that, and somebody brought out a metal stretcher and laid him on it. Well, first we laid him on the ground, and then we felt his pulse, and it was just barely doing it. It was real slow and real weak. His whole mouth and stuff is bashed up into his nose and stuff, and he couldn't breathe out his nose. He was trying to breathe out his mouth. There really wasn't anything you could do. We carried him over to some station wagon, then whoever owned the car hopped in and some other people hopped in and drove off, and I stayed there. I went over and they had this thing of coffee, and I poured it all over me to wipe off the blood. Reporter, hot coffee? Answer, yeah, because there was nothing else. And then I walked away feeling wanting to do something, wanting to tell somebody what happened. A young medical resident from the public health hospital in San Francisco named Robert Hyatt was the first doctor to reach Meredith Hunter. He was behind the stage and so was in a good position to respond when Mick Jagger called from the stage for a doctor. The following is a quote from Dr. Robert Hyatt. Quote, he had very serious wounds. He had a wound in the lower back which could have gone into the lungs, a wound in the back near the spine which could have severed a major vessel, and a very large wound in the left temple. You couldn't tell how deep the wounds were, but each was about 3/4 of an inch long, so they would have been fairly deep. It was just obvious he wasn't going to make it. There was no equipment there to treat him, and he needed to be operated on immediately, have a couple large vessels repaired. Treatment immediately would have been intravenous fluids, none of which were available. End quote. The Hell's Angel that killed Meredith Hunter was tried and acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. Meredith's sister, Gwen, was called to identify the body at the morgue. These were her memories of her brother. Quote, he was a very highly educated boy. He almost never raised his voice. He talked very quietly. That would make people mad when they wanted to fight. He'd talk very quietly, and he was so educated in the way he spoke. His job had just come through. He'd just gotten a job at the post office. End quote. Gwen said that Meredith had never been in any trouble. He had only ever been involved in one fight in his entire life, and that was to defend her. She did say that he did have a gun. Quote, It was almost always in the house. He had it for his own protection. He only took it out with him when he'd go to big affairs. I know he took it with him to the festival. He pulled it out and showed it to them, but only to make them stop and think while they were beating him. I know he never would have used it. The angels have the gun now. End quote. After Meredith had been removed by Robert Hyatt in a vain attempt to save his life, the Rolling Stones began again, knowing that if they stopped and abandoned the stage now, the already awful situation would get worse. So they continued on, alternating between grimly finishing their set list, begging the crowd to pull back and sit down and the Hell's Angels to stop their violence. At one point, the onstage angels surrounding the band menacingly in response, and despite the circumstances, play well, finish, and get out of there. They wouldn't find out about the deaths until the next day. Meredith Hunter was one of four who never came back home. Two young men were run over with a car. Not hit by a car. The vehicle was literally driven over their bodies, crushing their chests and killing them both. The driver of that car was never found. Another young man, theorized to be experiencing a bad acid trip, jumped into an irrigation canal and was quickly drowned in the swift waters. Richard Fine, who at the time was the chairman for the Medical Committee for Human Rights, labeled the concert promoters morally irresponsible for how the festival was conducted. Quote, "We had one day to mobilize medical personnel and supplies. We got shitty support from the people running the thing who didn't realize what was crucial from a medical standpoint and wouldn't give us the authority to do things such as set up a workable evacuation procedure. And we had no time to mobilize community people for help with bad trips. It was just piss poor planning. A lot of the bad trips were violent because there was so much violence in the air. There were a lot of beatings. Girls were beaten. I sewed up a lot of girls. It was like the fucking police tactical squad running around. We feel that we, as well as everyone else in the crowd, was exploited by the promoters." End quote. The medical people were supposed to have telephone communications. They were supposed to have a helicopter. They received neither. And while it was getting dark waiting for the Rolling Stones and tons of people were injured in the medical area, the representatives for the Stones refused to turn on the backstage lights so the medics could tend to them. The number of violence-induced injuries was unusually high, according to Fine. At one tent, doctors said that they treated 12, a skull fracture, one person with fractured facial bones, and 10 skull lacerations. And this wasn't even from the tent behind the stage, which was the first aid station closest to where the violence was happening, and the one that most of the injured would wind up in. Carlos Santana saw the fighting breaking out in front of him during the first set of the night. Quote, "There was bad vibes from the beginning. The fight started because the Hell's Angels were pushing people around. There was no provocation. The Angels started the whole violence thing, and there's no fucking doubt about that. You can blame Reds and liquor for the whole fucking mess. People just got themselves fucked up and wanted to fuck up everybody else. You lose control of and respect for yourself, and you lose control of and respect for anybody else. That's what happened. Reds and liquor did it." End quote. After the fact, most of the blame was laid at the feet of Rolling Stone management, the Hell's Angels, and the organizers. A few lawsuits were filed and a few penalties assessed. It would take until 2008 for Meredith Hunter's grave to receive a tombstone, paid for by crowdfunding. Here at Relative Disasters, we make sure to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters possible. This was a tricky episode to research, not because of lack of information, but almost too much of it, with a lot of it conflicting. If you'd like to know more about our sources, they are cited at the beginning of the episodes, and sometimes we do make mistakes, so if you have any thoughts you'd like to share or corrections we need to know, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to emails, but we do read every single one of them. Or if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram at relative.disasters? A gigantic thank you to our patrons who support us on Patreon. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. We've been ad-free from the beginning, and I feel like that's a nice thing to do for folks. As always, we'd like to thank our major disasters, Katie and Georgia, for their support and their fantastic sponsorship of local small open-air music festivals from sea to shining sea. And this week's episode is brought to you by Tasha, Hannah, Lauren, and Suzanne, stagehands and lighting technicians with a combined 100 years of experience in the field, available for your next venue and just a short Google search away. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode, and I want to thank you all for listening and sticking with me through this season. At this point, at least by the numbers, we're about halfway through our fourth season, and it looks like Ella won't be able to come back in any capacity this year. Keeping up with an episode a week has been getting more and more difficult for me, and I don't want the episode quality to suffer any more than it already has. So with that in mind, I'm going to be taking a few weeks off to try to recharge, refocus, reconfigure, and figure out the best way to keep this thing moving forward. I really enjoy doing it, and I'd like to keep doing it as long as you'd like to listen. The Patreon episodes are up to 2 a month now, so if you've been wondering whether they're worth checking out, this might be a fun way to get through the next few weeks until I am back. A lot of the feedback that I've received this year has pointed out that this season has been less than ideal, and I agree. I know that a big draw for everybody has been the back and forth with my sister and I. And just having me sit here talking at you is not super interesting. But I'm really grateful that you've decided to keep listening. So thank you. Have a good couple of weeks, and I'll be back with more disasters for you in the second half of the season.